It's hard to imagine a more varied jazz career than Bob Dorough's. As evidence, I offer the following. He played with Blossom Dearie, performed in an integrated army band during World War II, was commissioned to write an original Christmas song by Miles Davis, played his piano in between sets by comic Lenny Bruce, had a song covered by Mel Torme that was nominated for 2 Grammy Awards. He was musical director for a stage show starring boxer Sugar Ray Robinson, worked with avant-garde legend John Zorn, produced a record for poet Allen Ginsberg, was recruited for duets in the 1990s with Nellie Mackay, and in the 1970s produced rock and roll records for Spanky and Our Gang and counterculture band The Fugs. Oh, and he wrote this song.
Conjunction, junction, what's your function?
Hooking up words and phrases and clauses.
Conjunction, junction.
That's Jack Sheldon singing Bob's lyrics for Conjunction, Junction. Bob Dorough wrote most and sang many of the schoolhouse rock songs that entertained and educated millions of kids for the past 40 years. Bob Dorough will kick off the 2013 KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series Saturday night at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Last week, Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz programs on Friday and Saturday nights, called Bob Dorough and talked to him about a career that has included nightclubs, television, tours, and records. We'll hear some of the highlights from that conversation on today's Ozarks. Most biographies list Cherry Hill, Arkansas, as Bob Dorough's birthplace, but he told Robert that his earliest memories are in the even tinier community of Crossroads Village, Arkansas. It was in Arkansas, before his family moved to Texas, where Bob first sang. At age 4, in 1927, his aunt convinced him to enter an amateur contest at an Arkansas movie house.
So I entered the amateur contest, and I sang My Blue Heaven, verse and chorus. And when Polly was a little girl, which I guess I learned in school.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe your first breakout tune, Devil May Care, was originally recorded by the American swing jazz band leader, trumpeter, and a fellow Texan, Les Elgart. Is that
right? That's right.
Well, how did he get exposure to your writing and to your music?
Well, I never met Les. I met his arrangers, and one was his son, Larry Elgart, and one was Charles Albertine. But there was a vocalist, a sort of a Frank Sinatra type cat, who sang with the band. His name was Don Forbes, and one of my Texas pals had contacts. Maybe he had played saxophone in the saxophone section. But anyway, he gave Devil May Care to Don Forbes. So Don Forbes started singing it on their jobs, and eventually, I guess, the two arrangers wrote it up for him. And then they called one day and said, "We want to record your song." And I wrote it with a neighbor, a guy that lived in the same apartment building in New York, and so we went down and signed the contract, and we didn't read the fine print, but we were so excited. I didn't know much about the music business per se at that time, since I didn't have jazz education. But you know, I let them. They said, "We want to publish it." Okay, are you publishing it? No. I think you can publish it. So we signed up, and you know, for 28 years they owned the song, and they never. Never paid any statements or anything, and I wasn't hip enough to sue them or anything like that.
Oh, man.
However, their U.S. copyright law enabled me to take it away from them in 28 years later, which would have been about 71, I guess.
No cares for me, I'm happy as I can be. I learned to love and to live, devil may care. No cares, woes, whatever comes later goes. That's how I'll take and I'll give. Devil may care. When the day is through, I suffer no regrets.
You alluded to your sojourn out to the West Coast in the late 50s. You spent some time out there, and this is where you first met Miles Davis, wasn't it?
Yeah, I sort of got stranded in L.A. and started working, and Lenny Bruce helped me get a cabaret job, and then I got in a hot quintet where they needed a new piano player, and that was fun, a standard tenor sax and trumpet quintet. So I was living a double life of the cabaret singing and the bebop that we played with the jazz Savoys. And I wound up living in L.A. 3 years and sort of liked it, and it was a hot time. I met Don Cherry and Ornette Coleman and Paul Bley and Carla Bley and all the band from Ornette's quartet before they went to New York, before they made it big, mostly at jam sessions. And I had a few New Yorker friends who had moved to L.A. before me. And, of course, I'd heard Miles many times in New York, but you couldn't get close to him. You know, he'd sort of ignore you if you said, "Hey, Miles, that was a great set, man." He'd just walk on by, you know, wouldn't even say thanks or anything. But in L.A., we had a mutual friend. She was a jazz singer from Philly, and she used to know everybody because she was in this smaller city. So everybody that played the jazz club in Philadelphia usually met Terry Morrell. She admired the beboppers and the heavy hitters like that. So Miles, it seemed he liked to stay in someone's apartment if he could rather than a hotel. I don't know why. Just more informal, I guess, and less visible. Anyway, he was living in her landlady's home in Laurel Canyon. And she lived in the attic, and he'd come up in the afternoon, and my LP, the one with me in the orange Target there, was always prominently displayed on her shelves. And
that's the Devil May Care recording.
Yeah, one day he said, "What's that?" She said, "That's my pal, Bob. He writes songs and plays piano and sings. Let me hear it." And so she told me a day or two later that Miles had listened. She said to my whole LP, I find it hard to believe, but when she said that, I said, "Let's go to the gig." I don't think I was even going to go. He was on a 3-week engagement at a jazz club with Coltrane and Cannonball and Paul Chambers and Jimmy Cobb and I think Wynton Kelly.
Ooh, how could you not go to that gig, Bob?
Well, I'd heard so much of him in New York, and, you know, it costs money.
Right.
I wasn't known around the jazz club where I'd have to pay $10 or $15 to get in.
I see.
But when she said that, I said, "We're going tonight." So there she caught him off the bandstand while the cats were still finishing up a tune. You know how he was. He'd leave the stand after he played his choruses. Anyway, she said, "Miles, this is my friend I was telling you about." So he walked over to me, and instead of saying, "Pleased to meet you, loved your LP," or anything like that, he grabbed me by the wrist and whispered in my ear, "Bob, go up and sing Baltimore Oriole."
At the gig?
He drugged me up there.
Baltimore Oriole. She took a look at the mercury one day. Well, 'twas 40 below. No time for a lady to be dragging her feathers around in the snow. Leaving her mate, straight she flew to the Tangipaho, where a two-timing jaybird met the divine Miss O.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about your, can I call it your parallel career and and your accomplishments with the younger generation? I'm referring, of course, to the music and the lyrics and your involvement in the animated children's series Schoolhouse Rock.
Yeah, well, you know, in the 60s after I got back from L.A., and so I recorded with Miles, but I wasn't getting much work. You know, I'd go to an agent and he'd say, "You got a group?" And I'd say, "Sure, I got a group. Bass and drums and saxophone if you want or something." He said, no, I mean, you know, like the Beatles, like the Monkees, like the Rolling Stones, a group, you know, singing group. And I said, "Oh, no. Ben Tucker was my pal. We had worked together in L.A., bass and piano, and he was in New York, too, and he got a hit song called Coming Home, Baby, and with Herbie Mann at Newport.
Right, right.
And he asked me to write lyrics, and I did, and we wound up getting a Mel Torme recording of Coming Home, Baby. It's one of my most recorded songs, actually. And and I don't know, George Newell was an executive at the ad agency, and his boss, his president, had told him, do you know anyone that could put the, I'm trying to get someone to put the multiplication tables, because my little boys can't memorize their times tables even, but and yet they sing along with Jimi Hendrix and the Rolling Stones. And George said, well, I'll find someone. So he asked Ben one night at the Hickory House, where Ben was playing with Billy Taylor, who was admired greatly by George Newell, who actually, even though he was a great advertising writer, had majored in music at Florida State and could play the piano and loved jazz. So he was always going out to hear it. And he got Ben, and Ben said, Bob Dura, he can put anything to music. So anyway, I was called to a meeting, and suddenly I became, well, the first song I wrote knocked them off their feet. Three is a magic number.
Oh, my goodness.
Three is a magic number. Yes, it is. It's a magic number. Somewhere in the ancient mystic trinity, you get three as a magic number. The past and the present and the future, faith and hope and charity, the heart and the brain and the body give you three as a magic number.
Bob Doro will perform Saturday night at Walton Arts Center as the first concert in the KUAF Summer Jazz Concert Series. Tickets and more information are available at KUAF.com. For a digest of all things jazz, including the rest of the 15th Annual Concert Series, you can go to digjazz.com. Bob talked with Robert Ginsberg, the host of KUAF's Shades of Jazz on KUAF each Friday and Saturday night at 10 o'clock.
Yes, they do. They had three in the family. That's a magic number.
3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27, 30.
3, 6, 9, 12, 15, 18, 21, 24, 27.